Hello. In recent audio snippets, we have been talking about the U.S. presidents leading up to the American Civil War and how they, for the most part, maintained the status quo because of this half-hearted attitude or outright support towards slavery. And last time we were talking about James Buchanan, the 15th president of the United States, the president who was there right before the Civil War started. So we spoke of how he was the ultimate compromiser and was responsible for things just deteriorating into the Civil War, but clearly he's not the one to blame for it on his own. He was just the culmination of many, many, many decades of American incompetence or half-heartedness regarding the slavery issue. We are going to mention a little about the candidate that he ran against to be elected in 1856. And that candidate, his name is John Fremont. And he also ran against another third party candidate, who happened to be Millard Fillmore, the 13th president of the United States, whom we discussed earlier. He was the president from 1850 to 1853, you could say. He basically took over from the 12th president, Zachary Taylor, who died in office. He was the vice president. He became president and finished out Zachary Taylor's term. And he did a comeback in 1856 trying to get back to the White House. So he ran as a third-party candidate, which is kind of ironic because when he was in the White House, he accomplished little to anything. And he just wanted to get back to the White House to do more of the same. So there were these three candidates, John Fremont, Millard Fillmore as a third-party candidate, and James Buchanan. And John Fremont is a very kind of interesting person to consider in the context of slavery in America and right up to the beginning of the Civil War. It's interesting that John Fremont was born in Savannah, Georgia, and apparently he was an illegitimate child of a woman who from the South, who apparently had an affair with I believe he was a French Canadian or something to that effect, who was working in her household, and so they had an affair or something happened, and he was born, John Fremont was officially the first Republican presidential candidate in American history. And he was not just opposed to slavery, he was deeply opposed to it, which is interesting because of the fact that he was born in the South. And it's interesting also because he was fittingly born in Savannah, Georgia. And as you may recall from previous audio snippets, Georgia had this calling from the very beginning to be the epicenter from which slavery would be removed from the country. So it's not a coincidence that this man was born in Savannah, Georgia, even though he was born in the Deep South, he was deeply opposed to slavery, and he ended up kind of migrating and he made it all the way to California and turned out to become one of the first two senators elected from the state of California in 1850. So, California was allowed into the Union shortly after the Gold Rush of 1849. And as it entered the Union, then it was allowed to elect two senators, and one of those was Fremont. And he, as we said, was the first Republican presidential candidate representing the Republican Party, which had been formed in 1854, 2 years before the 1856 election. And this Republican Party united against the Pierce administration and the spread of slavery to the West. So as the opposition to slavery kind of consolidated, the Republican Party was born. And it's a shame that the Republican Party doesn't have that connection to that past anymore. It lost it. It was born out of people who were committed to transforming the lives of Black people in Black America. And sadly, that calling, that sense of duty that gave birth to the Republican Party, that call, that sense of duty disappeared. And the Republican Party has become largely indifferent towards Black America, in the sense of not really understanding what happened or ever acting as the voice that defends the freedom of Black people, which would imply also promoting the responsibility of Black people, because with freedom comes responsibility. But the Republican Party has not done any of that. But it's ironic considering how it was born. And Fremont was very important in American history because he played a major role in the opening up of the American West to settlement by pioneers, American pioneers. He served. So he was helpful in that expansion of the of America towards the West because of his military involvement, you could say. He didn't win the election of 1856. Obviously, he lost to James Buchanan. Eventually, when the Civil War started, he served in the army, and he defeated the Confederates, the Southerners, in Springfield, Missouri. And his defeat there was the only successful Union battle in the Western Department in the year of 1861, when the Civil War started. So in other words, he was the first person or first leader, a military leader from the Union who experienced victory against the South on the Western front of the war. He had this more militant attitude, and when I say militant, I mean he had this very strong proactive attitude. He didn't see the Civil War as an inconvenience that we had to get over or get past to just get back to the way we were before. He understood that the Civil War, in a sense, was the opportunity to terminate the current state of things so that we wouldn't be tormented by that state of things anymore, so that we could have not only peace regarding the slavery issue, but having justice, divine justice in the land. And because of that proactive attitude, Fremont raised volunteer troops. He would purchase open market weapons and equipment, and So he was not just standing there. He was like actively doing things. And he even sent his wife, Jessie, to Washington, D.C. To lobby President Lincoln for more reinforcements where he was stationed. And while he was commanding the Department of the West, Fremont was looking for a general to command a post at Cairo, at a place in the South. And he was first going to appoint a man called John Pope. But upon the recommendation of another major, he ended up interviewing Ulysses S. Grant. And Grant had a reputation for being like a drifter and a drunkard. But Fremont kind of saw Grant with his own eyes and saw the value and potential in him. And he paid no attention to the reputation that had been labeled on Grant, because Grant apparently was a bit of a drinker, and that kind of labeled him as a drunkard, and overshadowed his very valuable qualities. And Fremont, when thinking about Grant, thought that he was, he wrote, an unassuming character not given to self-elation, of dogged persistence, of iron will. So this man saw the value in Ulysses S. Grant, and thank God that he did, because that Fremont chose Grant and appointed him commander of the Cairo post in October of 1861. So that's how Grant started to gain relevance and notoriety within the Union Army because of Fremont. And that's very important. People don't really talk much about Fremont in American history. If you ask most Americans, they would probably have to not have a clue who he was, but he was a very, very important person. For many reasons, not just because he was the first Republican candidate, but because of the things he did, even though he didn't make it to the White House, you could say, as a president. And the sad thing is that he was relieved of command by Lincoln for insubordination. What happened is that whilst in charge of the Western Department of the Union Army, he was expected to consult with Lincoln or Army headquarters about all decisions. There was one point where he actually issued an authorized emancipation edict. So he was declaring the freedom of slaves. And so he practically did what Lincoln half-heartedly did, and we'll talk about that later, in 1863 with the Emancipation Proclamation. He did it earlier, but he did it without consulting with Lincoln, and Lincoln was infuriated that Fremont had done this, and he just dismissed him. So he was let go. This man who had given the Union Army their first victory in the West was just simply summarily dismissed. Fremont kept pushing Lincoln, you know, help us with reinforcements. We can get this done. He had the initiative. And Lincoln, instead of seeing that as a sign of a person who has to be enabled, maybe he had to be reined in certain ways. Maybe there was a certain effusiveness about him that needed to be contained in some way, that is possible, but you don't let people like that go. And Lincoln, son of a bitch, Lincoln, being the idiot that he was, he let him go, and it kind of exposed what was inside of Lincoln. Lincoln was not fighting to free black people. He just wanted the South to get back into the Union. That's what he was concerned about. And when Fremont did this, he saw it as as something that would make him look bad and would anger the South even more. So the South was angry enough already. You know, it's like a lion or a tiger charging at you, ready to maul you, to destroy you, to tear you to pieces, and you're trying to beat the tiger with this steel rod, and then someone saying, "How dare you beat up the tiger? You're gonna get him angry. He's angry already. He's about to kill you. You have to fight back and kill it." And while you're trying to fight against it, there's someone refereeing in favor of the tiger and saying, "Don't get the tiger angry," when the tiger is furious already. So that just shows, the stupidity of Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln was an idiot at the end. And we will talk more about Lincoln in this audio snippet. So he didn't understand. It's as if he was being divinely shown what needed to be done early on in the war. You need to turn this war into a war of moral conviction, where the Union Army and their soldiers know we are here to end an injustice that's been going on for decades and decades and decades in this nation. We have to make it stop. And as we've explained before, slavery was supposed to be. Black people deserve to be enslaved for a period. And that's a very harsh thing to say, but it is the reality of it. And we've explained ad nauseum why that's the case. But slavery was like a prison sentence, a collective prison sentence for Black people to pay the price or the punishment for things that they had refused to do before. And they were dragged off from all that corruption in Africa and dragged to America and forced to start anew. And it was for a period. And by the time America was about to be born, that's when that period was supposed to end. And once it was declared that it had to end, it started with the birth of the state of Georgia, as we've said a million times before. When it was declared that it had to end, we had to phase it out. And we were given 40, 50 years to do it and phase it out so that by the time the nation was born, we would be well on our way to ending it. And so that by the time we got to writing the Constitution, we would be completely free of slavery. But that never happened. Once we crossed that line of allowing slavery past that point, then it became this great evil that we were committing. It's like someone who, committed some crime and was in jail, deservedly so, for 15 years. And once the 15 years were up, if you don't let that person go and you keep them in chains and you keep abusing them and beating down on them, then the criminal is no longer the person who's in jail. It's the one keeping him in jail. And that's what happened in America. And Lincoln didn't understand that we had to make that switch, that moral switch, that the Union was not army was not fighting to preserve the country. It was fighting to declare a judgment on the warden who wouldn't let the prisoner free from prison, even though his sentence was long over, and was punishing him and torturing him. And the Union Army had to beat the hell out of the South and humiliate them and wipe them out, not literally, but morally speaking, in terms of morale, destroy them, destroy their psyche, destroy their soul, so that they would pay for what they were doing. defying the divine commandment to end slavery in the country. And had Lincoln turned that switch on, the Civil War would have ended much more quickly, and the consequences after the Civil War would have been much more profound. And yes, there were a lot, there were still division in the country, lots of people fighting or arguing on both sides. Here in the North, there were a lot of people who were opposed to the abolitionist movement of slavery, even though there were a lot of people who were against slavery. There were also a lot of people who were okay with it and were upset with Lincoln because they saw him as this guy who was coming to end slavery. And he never was that guy. That was more like an image that was kind of divinely placed on him, even against his will, because the time had come to end slavery. So Lincoln was, every time people saw him, a lot of people, they saw him as the man who was going to wipe out slavery from America, who came for that purpose. And Lincoln, it's as if he was given this disguise or this coat that he would wear, and he was not aware of it, and he hated the coat, but it was placed on him and to trigger a certain reaction in people, to kind of get things to get to the point where things would finally begin to change. So there was a lot of conflict and division. So yes, and a lot of people use that as an excuse to say, well, Lincoln was doing the best he could. He was such a wise man, kind of juggling all these conflicting people, like the radical Republicans, because he was a moderate Republican. He was considered a moderate Republican, and that's a term for the people in the Republican Party who were not as abolitionists as the, quote, radical Republicans. That was another label. So you either were a moderate Republican or a radical Republican. Using modern terminology, you were either a rhino or a conservative, let's say. So Lincoln was a rhino, a Republican in name only, even though he was the first Republican president, ironically, but he was a rhino of his time. His juggling of things was not because he was a wise man. It was because he was a man who did not have the character, the principles to do what's right. When you juggle good and evil like that, you're not being wise. You are compromising, and that's what Lincoln was doing. He was committed to not being committed, and even though he spoke out against slavery before becoming president, a lot of it was just words. It was really not action. He was just louder. His words were louder than most people's. But at the end of the day, he was like all the other presidents before him, who thought slavery was evil, but were not going to do anything to really end it, to actively end it. But he could have, so he was facing these factions and all these conflicts, but he could have been a little bit more like a fox, like a wily fox, and use a strategy of promoting the end of slavery, the outright end of slavery, and at the same time disguising certain things to prevent the opposition, the compromisers in the North ganging up on him. So he could have used that strategy of like, okay, I'm not going to tell you everything I plan to do, but I'll tell you enough to promote what I want. I want the end of slavery, and I want the sons of bitches in the South to pay the price for what they are doing. They are going to pay. But obviously he was not going to be saying it, quite like that, literally. But that's what he had to have inside his heart. and then kind of let that out in a very subtle way, so that he could impart that hatred towards the Union Army and towards those in the North against the South and the evil they were committing. There was one person in the Army, the Union Army, and we'll talk about him at a future time, who had that attitude. And his name was William Tecumseh Sherman, the man who one of the greatest generals in American history, probably the greatest, I would dare say. And he was the one responsible for, he along with Grant, were the ones responsible for finalizing the Civil War and bringing it to a close and causing the end of slavery. It wasn't Lincoln. It was Sherman and Grant. And Sherman had that attitude. But it was an attitude that was also mixed in with a compassion that Lincoln had too much of towards the South. But it was a compassion that said, okay, I will punish you. I'll make you go through hell. And when your knees are bent and you're down on the ground and you realize you did evil, then we will extend compassion towards you and help you get back up from off your knees. But we're not going to extend compassion to you until you bend your knee. So when we talk about hatred and these things like that, it's not in the way that most people would think it is. It is a hatred where you want the person to repent, and you want the person to recognize that they have done wrong. And you know the person's recalcitrant, the person is arrogant, the person is stubborn, the person is evil, and you're going to go against him and break his will and destroy him. When I say destroy him, it's destroy that, bring him to the point where he is no longer himself, and he has to fall down to the ground and say, I am sorry for what I have done. And if the person is not ever going to get to that point, might as well kill him and wipe him off the face of the earth. And that was the attitude that we had to have towards the South, to not only end slavery, but heal the South, because the South really never healed. And I know I'm slightly digressing from the original line that we were following, but just as a side note, I was reminded of a recent episode on television that I saw. It was a television show, I think, about haunted houses, and they were in some house in the South. And it was interesting as I was watching it, because you know, they were like in the dark, and suddenly someone heard a noise, and one of the persons turned around and said, who is that? Are you a scumbag Yankee? Are you a Union soldier? You scumbag Yankee or something like that? Because apparently some people thought that that house was haunted by the ghost of Civil War soldiers, and the point of sharing this is that it just drew my attention how this guy from the South, his gut reaction, his visceral reaction to this state of fear of hearing this noise, was to say, are you a scumbag Yankee? And he wasn't just saying it as a joke. I mean, you could hear and you could see, because they had this, you know, night vision camera going, you could see the rage in him. He really, really, really was very bitter and resentful and angry at the Yankee, at this Union soldier. And that tells you the South really never healed. Because we know why the Union soldiers were fighting. They were fighting to set black people free. And the Confederates were fighting to maintain black people in slavery. And some people say, oh, well, no, the Confederates were fighting for state rights. State rights, my rear end, that's not what they were fighting for. The state rights was the legal term used to excuse, federalism was the excuse behind slavery, but they were not there just for state rights. I mean, for crying out loud, do you really think that's what they were fighting about? They were fighting because they wanted to keep their slaves. Plain and simple. I mean, anyone who doesn't believe that or doesn't see it that way is being self-deceiving. That is the reality. They were angry at slavery, the slaves being taken away from them. And they said, because that's a violation of our state rights. You know, it's like someone saying, I'm here beating up my wife inside my house, and you're trying to break into my house to stop me from beating her up and possibly killing her. And how dare you violate the privacy of my home? That was their attitude. So they were not fighting for the privacy of their home. They were fighting to have the right to continue beating their wife to a pulp, figuratively speaking. And this guy, we know this now. I mean, maybe it wasn't that clear. I mean, I don't know. You have to be an idiot even back in the 1800s not to have known that this was what was going on. But let's just give them this very broad benefit of the doubt to the people in the South, that they were too stupid to understand what was going on, and they really thought that they were fighting this noble cause. You know, hurrah, hurrah for Southern rights, hurrah, hurrah for the bloody blue flag that bears the single star. There's a song that kind of goes like that, and I was actually taught that song in eighth grade, which is interesting, and I still remember a lot of it. And I remember the how the song went, the tune, and I when I think about it, I sometimes wonder why were we taught that song. It's like, my goodness, it's a song of people promoting evil, or fighting for evil. But so the thing is that they might not have understood what was going on back in the 1800s. But now we know what happened. We can look back and say, yeah, that was the good against evil. You know, just as clear as you can paint it. The Union were the good guys. The South, the Confederates, were the Federalists, the ones who promote federalism, were the bad guys. And yes, even if you're from the South, you should be able to look back and say, yeah, my ancestors fought on the side of evil. And I'm ashamed of that past. I am sorry that we did that. We were so stupid. We didn't realize it. But we're grateful the Union won. And now we are a one nation again. And there is no slavery. But no. This guy, his visceral reaction was, scumbag Yankee. You evil Union. You Yankee piece of dirt that came to the South to fight us and kill us. And prevent us doing what we were doing, which was to maintain slavery. So the South never really healed, but it never really healed. And when I say healing, it's not like healing in terms of, oh, my feelings are hurt. No, I'm saying healing in terms of the evil being dealt with, and just being free and healed, and be a person who is righteous and true and free again. And that never happened because there were not enough Shermans. There were not enough people who had this attitude of, okay, we're going to bring you to your knees, you sons of bitches, Southerners. We're going to bring you to your knees. We're going to humiliate you. And when you're down on the ground and recognize that you have sinned before God and man, then we're going to extend our forgiveness towards you and see that you get up, and become a brother again. But until then, we're going to beat the hell out of you and humiliate you and spit on you and stomp on you until you recognize what you've done. So going back to Fremont had that attitude in him as well. And Lincoln didn't like that. That's why he was dismissed from the army, and Lincoln actually issued two emancipation proclamations. And he was this proactive guy. He knew we had to go get those sons of bitches in the South. And I'm using, I know that sounds like a vulgar term, but that's what we had, how we had to see them. They were not the brothers who were in rebellion. You know, they were the sons of bitches who are getting in the way of justice and the rest and the fulfillment of this nation's destiny. We saw how slavery was this issue that just kept preventing America growing freely, because I do believe in the manifest destiny. America had this calling to go from, literally as the song says, from sea to shining sea, and the Mexican-American War was part of that expansion. Imagine what all that territory that used to be belong to Mexico would be like if Mexico had kept it. And I've said this a million times. If you want to know what that territory would have looked like, just go to Tijuana. Just cross the border, you know, the southern border in California. Go from California into Tijuana, and it's like night and day. You know, it's almost the same territory. You're just crossing this imaginary line, you could say, drawn by man, saying this is the end of the U.S., this is the beginning of Mexico, and it's like night and day, completely different. You can feel the backwardness just the moment you cross the line. And that's how it would be, just this backward, undeveloped territory. So the destiny of America was to conquer that territory, and we weren't able to do that because of slavery. We couldn't grow as a nation because we still had this lingering cancer within us. And we had this to take this proactive attitude of ending it, but Lincoln just kept trying to kind of play it both ways. Yes, we fight the South to bring them into the Union, but not angering them so much that they will not want to sit down at the table and agree to return home. And by the way, Fremont eventually went on to serve as the governor of Arizona from 1878 to 1871, and then he retired from politics. And the sad thing about him is that he ended up dying destitute in, of all places, New York City. This is being recorded outside of New York City in the New York metropolitan area. So he died in this area that I'm speaking from as a poor man, which is so sad, in 1890. One of the, I would believe, one of the most important figures in American history. I would put him in the top 20 greatest Americans of all time because of his relevance. He brought, even though he was never president, you know, he did fight in the Civil War for a short time, but was obviously, as we're describing, dismissed by Lincoln. So he didn't get a chance to stay in the army and fight and have all the victories that he could have had. So you may think, oh, he really didn't have much of an impact, but just his presence, his moral presence in the country, was important to affect the little change that was done through the Civil War and after. You have no idea what happens through people who may not be well known or have achieved great things, but whose moral character and content, just by their very presence, creates a transformation of history and things around them. And Fremont was one of those people. And just as a side note, when he, as we were saying earlier, he was the illegitimate son of a wealthy Southern lady, and I think a French Canadian fellow who was working at the household where this woman was. She was married to a guy, and she had the affair with the French Canadian, and Fremont was born. And the thing is that if I remember correctly, I think she and the father kind of fled the plantation, I think in Virginia, if I remember correctly, and ended up kind of traveling south, and they ended up having the baby in Savannah, Georgia. So it's as if destiny was calling them. That baby could not be born in Virginia or whatever state they were in originally, and they started migrating south and ended up in Georgia, in Savannah, which I believe, if I remember correctly, was the first city. I could be wrong with this, but I think it was the first city established by Oglethorpe, who founded Georgia. And we talked about him earlier, this British fellow who believed in giving people who had a debt, a literal monetary debt, and who were in debtor's prison, giving people like that a second opportunity in life, which is what basically slavery and the freedom of slaves was about. Giving people who had a debt, a moral debt, to their maker, giving them a second opportunity. Okay, now you've paid your debt, now you can start a new life. So he founded Savannah, Georgia, and it's like as if the mother of Fremont and her father, if I'm not mistaken, were drawn somehow through circumstances into the city for the child to be born there. And I think eventually Fremont also grew up in South Carolina. He was born in Georgia, and I think they eventually went back north towards South Carolina, and that's where he grew up for a while and so forth. And it's amazing that having grown up in the South, enveloped in that environment, Fremont was opposed to slavery, deeply opposed to it. And it's also interesting that he had to have Canadian blood in him. Canada, part of the British Empire, which had freed up slaves already. And it's like he had this infusion from the outside. And even though he was immersed in this very pro-slavery atmosphere, he never was contaminated by it and actually became a champion against it. And that's the type of people Lincoln should have seen if he had the right attitude, go, this is the guy I need, people like him. And instead he just dismissed him. Instead of just channeling him and using him as another a firebrand, another powerful force that would morally propel the Union Army into victory. Now that we have talked about it, and the sad thing is he died in New York poor in 1890, and that's a very sad end for one of the greatest Americans of all time. And again, you might say, what did he accomplish? And if after hearing this, you really haven't understood what I'm talking about, then I guess there is no point in trying to convince you. But he was one of the people who gave this country enough moral character to end slavery. Just by his presence. He had this attitude that others did not have, and Lincoln should have learned from him instead of dismissing him. And Lincoln is not in the top 20 greatest Americans of all time, not in the top 50, not in the top 100. He's not even in the top 1 million or 2 million or 3 million. That's how pathetic Lincoln is. Lincoln is one of the worst presidents in American history. So now let's talk about Lincoln. Lincoln, as you know, was the 16th president of the United States from 1861 to 1865. And his attitude towards slavery while president at the beginning was to try to persuade the states to agree to compensation for emancipating their slaves in return for their acceptance of abolition. So that was that's a good attitude in the sense that yes, we're asking you to set the slaves free, and we're going to compensate you, but it was always this passive attitude. It's not like okay, slavery is evil, and you're going to end it right now. And yes, we're going to be fair with you, but you're going to end it right now. And he didn't have to be overtly that way. He just had to have the attitude inside. And it would probably every now and then just emanate from him in his speeches without him saying it. So he needed to have a certain level of sneakiness about him, in the sense of, I am here to set the black man free. That's what I'm here for. That's why I was put on earth. This is one of the purposes in my life, a historical purpose. I will get this done. But without, you know, just overtly saying it out loud in a literal way. So you can do a lot of things without actually saying them. And then through your actions, you start kind of saying what's inside of you. And then using other tactics. I don't mean lying or deceiving, but it is deceiving, but without lying, where you take this attitude and you're not saying what you really mean, but you're doing it. You're being very clear about what you mean, but you're not saying it. And that and when other people try to come at you, you can kind of, like, without lying or going into compromise or unrighteousness, kind of throw them off. It's like being wise as a fox and gentle as a dove at the same time. Lincoln, as we said, rejected Fremont's two emancipation attempts in August of 1861. And there was another emancipation attempt done by another general called David Hunter in May of 1862. So there were a few people inside the army who said, okay, we're here to set the black man free. And let's go ahead and say it, because this is what this war is about. And Lincoln was opposed to it. And his anger was that the excuse he gave was that, these men did not have the power or the constitutional authority or the right to do that. And also, obviously, he was concerned about angering loyal border states. Like, for example, the state of Maryland. I grew up in Baltimore, Maryland. Sadly, Maryland was a slave state. It stayed with the North, but it was a slave state. And Maryland was, Washington, D.C. is sandwiched between Maryland and Washington, because it was taken from land, I think mostly from Maryland. To me, Washington has always been like the second big city in Maryland. Maybe because I grew up in Baltimore, that's how I see it. But I think a little bit of that land must have come from Virginia as well. And so Lincoln, living in Washington, D.C., might have been very concerned about Maryland, deciding to join the South. And they never did, but they apparently were very close, or literally on the borderline of joining the South. And if Maryland had joined the South, that would have kind of changed the whole dynamic of the war, I think, because then Washington, D.C. would be trapped between two Southern Confederate states, Maryland and Virginia. And so Lincoln was apparently very concerned, constantly concerned about Maryland turning to the South, and he didn't want to anger these border states. There were other border states that like Maryland, that did not join the South, and he was concerned about not upsetting them. The thing is, in June of 1862, so we're talking about more than 1 year into the Civil War, which started in April of 1861, Congress passed an act banning slavery on all federal territory, and Lincoln signed it. So 1 year had gone by. Imagine that. And a lot of people had been dying, not that many, because the Union Army was not really fighting as strongly, as decisively as it did later on. But people were dying. We were 1 year into the war. And it was until then that Congress had to pass the act banning slavery in all federal territories, and Lincoln signed it. And it's interesting, he never actively promoted the end outright end of slavery in the Union, so that Maryland and other places would not have it. So he wasn't getting it, that this was the golden opportunity that history was placing before him to make the change, a change that the Constitution did not allow him to do. And as we've said before, and we'll keep saying it ad nauseum, the current U.S. Constitution is a piece of trash. It is poorly written, it's poorly drafted, it doesn't define the executive branch correctly, it doesn't define it at all. That's why it's been this mushy thing that no one knows how to define. It doesn't define the judicial branch properly, and maybe we'll finally get to speaking about that. We've not discussed those two branches, how they are poorly defined in the Constitution. So it's a document just lacking in so many things. It doesn't defend black people at all, or slavery. There was no grounds to end slavery based on the Constitution, not even a groundwork. I understand, okay, let's accept, it's not an acceptable thing, but just for the moment, for the sake of argument, let's say it was necessary for the Constitution to be born in this state of half-slave, half-free America. But there was nothing left there as a seed that could be used to end slavery years down the road. Nothing, because the right to life is not there. The right to life is the right from which freedom emanates. And we've discussed the right to life in detail. One of the five fundamental human rights: the right to life, the right to property, the right to privacy, the right to a fair reputation, and the right to a personal domain. Those are the five human rights. And the right to life is not defined there. And that's because the right to life is not defined there, the closest, as we've said before, to the right to life is the First Amendment. Freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and all these other random laundry list of things that they came up with. But there was never a general concept of the right to life in the Constitution. So there was never any grounds to end slavery. So if Lincoln was waiting for the Constitution to tell him, I can end slavery now, it was never going to happen. And he could have been one of the galvanizing forces in history to say, hey, look at what's happening to our country now. We've not been a country for 100 years, and we have already split into, we're falling apart under this federalism piece of trash that we have built. It is time not only to end slavery, but to revisit the whole federalist system, and as we're doing that, to revisit the whole concept of the Constitution, how it was drafted. It has a lot of good ideas. I've always said this, even though I call it trash and a horrible document. It's not horrible in the sense of promoting freedom. It's not horrible the way liberals say it, because it doesn't have communism embedded in it. It's horrible because it does not define freedom correctly. It does not. It is limited. The Constitution is very limited in its ability to be the foundation to build a real, true government with all the qualities that the Founding Fathers wanted in a government and more. So there might have been some good intentions, some good ideas we can kind of things from a fire, you know, after you go through the rubble, the debris of a fire, and you find some good things here and there. We can grab some good things from the Constitution and then be aware of these good things whilst we're writing the new Constitution. But the Constitution itself is a piece of trash. And Lincoln, it was no time to be worrying about constitutional limitations and what is right, what is wrong. Because what is right and what is wrong is slavery had to end. And we have to define a document, a framework that can allow the country to really be the promoter of freedom on earth. That we all knew it was meant to be. Everybody knew in America. America was the land of the free, the land of freedom, the land of individual liberty. Everyone knew that. The concept was there. So that's kind of floating in the Constitution. And that's a good thing about that. But that does not mean the Constitution is a good document. And you have to distinguish between the two things. The idea is floating there, but it's not correctly defined or formalized. And that's what we're doing in these audio snippets, talking about these things. And Lincoln could have been one of these forces. He was a good orator, and he could have used this opportunity to start awakening the American people not only to the need to end slavery, but the need to reform the system. Because we were seeing the system falling apart right in front of our eyes. And you could say, oh, it didn't really fall apart. It was just 5 years of conflict, and then we went back to normal. Really? Really? And so you consider everything that happened after the Civil War going back to normal? Do you really know what happened in the South after the Civil War? Do you know what happened after Reconstruction? Do you really have any idea? And why did we have to have, all the protests of the 1960s, 100 years later, if everything had got, was okay and back to normal? Why do we have the decaying of the country at the time of these recordings? The country is dying. And in a sense, the American Republic is dead since November 5th, 2008. We've been in a state of coma. And I'm waiting for this country to wake up from its coma and see that, we need to change. And it's not happening. And we have like 16 or 14 months left. If something does not drastically happen, something drastic, if it doesn't happen, and causing people to wake up from this stupidity, then the country will be dead. We've gone through so much at the time of this recording, and conservatives still don't get it. They still don't get it. We've not learned a single thing, and most people the conservatives just want Trump back in the White House, as if that's going to solve everything. That stupid idiot who got ousted and outwitted by his own his own staff, outwitted out of the office, Oval Office. The guy who was playing so much 3D chess that he checkmated himself out of office. That's the guy we want back. The guy who brought Ivanka and Jared to closet Democrats into the White House to give him advice and undermine him from within. And the guy who promoted the rape by injection, all these, mRNA injections, and that are killing people. So many stories of suddenly someone died. Suddenly this person died. Suddenly this person died. And this is the guy we want back. And so we're not learning anything. We're in this situation, and speaking of that, I'm digressing a bit, but I believe this is all relevant. This week, Ivana, the mother of Ivanka, died, and she died, quote, suddenly again, and apparently with some sort of trauma. She apparently, I don't know the details, but I think it seems like she had some sort of heart situation, and she must have had a heart attack going down the stairs or something like that, and she hurt herself, and the combination of the injuries, the physical injuries and the heart attack, killed her. And she was 73. She was the mother of Ivanka and Don Jr. and Eric, the only really rescuable son of Trump, aside from Barron Trump, of course, who is not full siblings with the other three, because he has a different mother. But Eric and Barron are the only rescuable ones. Don Jr. is just a promote. It's just he's a good meaning fellow, but he's just superficial. Superficial cheerleader. That's how I perceive him. And Ivanka is just an outright agent of the enemy. And as you know, Ivanka publicly declared that she was not in agreement with her daddy about the election being stolen in 2020. And that says everything you need to know about her. If that's not enough, aside from all the other things she clearly did. And that's kind of like a little like shock. And hopefully, I keep hoping that Trump will be dead soon too, and he will he will probably be in a rally criticizing the war in Ukraine, the support of the war in Ukraine, criticizing the war in Iraq, how did we spend all this money and go to fight this useless war in Iraq. And he'll be touting the benefits and the millions of lives he saved with these mRNA injections. And as he's bragging about these things, just like Herod in the old days, and people are going to be acclaiming him and praising him, and suddenly, boom, jab-induced heart attack, and he's going to drop to the floor in front of everybody, and he'll be dead. And that will probably be an event that will shock people and hopefully send a message, and people will see that and start thinking about everything. And prompt them to wake up. And that's probably one of the events that's going to happen that might wake up this nation before it dies. But the more time passes, the less hope I have that this country will wake up. We are probably the most stupid generation of Americans in American history. And the chances are very, very low. And they're going down by the minute, and by the month, and by the year. And but maybe that will be one of the things that wake us up. And to prevent Trump being, having Trump's death being the source of celebration for all the liberals, then Biden also needs to, the son of a bitch, the senile bastard who shuffles his feet in the White House at the time of this recording, that little hair-sniffing pedophile, will also be dead too. So they will die probably within a month of each other. And the death of the two will say, okay, neither you whore liberals nor you idiot conservatives will have a reason to dance and rejoice, thinking that they have been vindicated by, divine intervention, through the deaths of these people, because they will both be in sorrow, as if to say, neither of you had the right solution. Neither of you were right. And maybe that will wake people up. But we'll see. We'll see. And if this nation doesn't wake up, then the new American Constitution will be written somewhere else, in some other country, some other way, but in some form of an or another, everything we've been saying will be plastered somehow in a document and will be the foundation of some government somewhere, somehow. Because the truth cannot be buried. But the thing is, with this act of in 1862 that banned slavery in all federal territory, you still have this situation where the North, being embroiled in this bitter war with the South, was still kind of like struggling to find a way to kind of end slavery in its own North. So you can see, I mean, how can the South be told to set their slaves free when the North was still hesitant about it, instead of just having the bravery of going ahead and doing it, and Lincoln leading the effort? If Lincoln had led the effort and had been able to verbalize the moral character of the battle being fought, then he would have galvanized the American people in the North against slavery, and we would have been able to end slavery in the North outright, and then declare the war on slavery in the South, and go out and kick some Southern ass and humiliate them, destroy them, and embarrass them, and spit on them until they recognize that they were wrong and needed to be healed from the evil inside of them, but that never happened. In July of 1862, the Confiscation Act of 1862 was enacted. And that provided core procedures to free the slaves of those convicted of aiding the rebellion. So it was providing core procedures to free the slaves of those convicted of aiding in the rebellion. And Lincoln approved the bill despite his belief that the bill was unconstitutional. So he was concerned about the constitutionality of it. He signed it anyway, but it was still tied up to this document. Instead of having this moment of reflection and saying, you know, this document's really not helping us much. You know, like, I'm trying to get something done here, and this document's not giving me any legal or moral framework or foundation to stand on. Think about that. That's how terrible the document was. And some people in the South and some modern conservatives hate Lincoln, not for the reasons that I hate Lincoln, that I have voiced in these audio snippets, but because they see Lincoln as this tyrant who went beyond the legal bounds of the Constitution and did not defend state rights. When I hear these modern-day conservatives talk like that, I go, my goodness, so you're supporting slavery again? No, I'm supporting state rights. For crying out loud, don't you see that that was what protected slavery from being destroyed or dealt with? People clinging to state rights? And you're still in that, and you're seeing Lincoln as a tyrant because he came to enforce a human right. So instead of saying, oh, the Constitution is not defending this human right, so human right trumps the Constitution every day, all day, every day, in anybody's book, if they're decent people. And when I'm saying human rights, I'm not talking about the human rights of the UN. Those are stupid human rights. Those are communist human rights. I'm talking about the real human rights, the five that we have described: the right to life, the right to property, the right to privacy, the right to a fair reputation, and a right to a personal domain. When fundamental rights, inalienable rights that are not given by government, remember, the conservative keeps saying that all the time, our rights come not from the government, they come from God. So they are inalienable. We are born with those rights. So that means, if I understand correctly, that not even the Constitution is the one granting me the rights, correct? You go, the Constitution defends our rights. Well, okay, how does it defend your right to property? Tell me the amendment, the bill, the article or the clause that protects your inalienable right to property. Where the hell is it? Where in that stupid document? Where is it? I don't know. Well, okay. So if something violates the right to property and I can't use the Constitution to defend it, or the Constitution limits me from having my right to property protected, then should we question the Constitution, or should we question the one trying to violate the Constitution to protect the right to property? Do you see what I'm saying? And we've said before, the Constitution actually fights against the right to property, and we've gone through the story of the 11th Amendment in a previous audio snippet. How that amendment, which was born out of a person trying to fight for his right to property, and because there was some sort of loophole that allowed the judicial branch to rule in favor of these people who were fighting for the right to property over state rights, because that happened, Congress said, oh, we have to reinforce state rights in the Constitution, and they put in the 11th Amendment to undermine the right to property when it came against state rights. So the Constitution does not protect you. Like, for example, the excessive taxation. One thing in America that is not present in other countries is that you can go live in another country and, you know, start your whole life in a whole new country and get a job in a new country, make money in a new country, and live there, and never come back to America, and you still owe taxes to the U.S. government every year. Even if you never come back to the U.S. as an American citizen, you still owe the American government, the federal government, taxes. That's a violation of your human rights, of your right to property. So the Constitution does not protect your rights. So they don't come from the Constitution. right? They don't even, the Constitution doesn't even protect a lot of your rights. So if you have to choose between a moment, a historical moment where you have to fight for a human right and upholding the Constitution, which are you going to choose? And conservatives keep choosing the Constitution as if it was some divinely inspired document, when it's a piece of, I can't say the word. I've never said the word, actually, in my whole life. But let's use the synonym, a piece of excrement. That's what it is. And you're defending a piece of excrement against a legitimate, tangible, almost tangible metaphysical right and truth. And Lincoln kept kind of debating that. He was in a position, like no other American in American history, to kind of voice to the people, our Constitution sucks, and it sucks to high heaven, and we have to find a way to rewrite this whole thing. Let's beat the hell out of the South and humiliate them, and tread on that stupid Alabama snake and put our boot on it and grind it until it's dead, and then let's fix this thing. Because theoretically, under the Constitution, see, the conservatives always say, I know I'm digressing and we're going to end it here for now with Lincoln. We'll talk about a lot more about Lincoln later, but in a future audio snippet. But conservatives always say that the national government or the federal government owes its existence to the states. The states gave it the go ahead, the okay, the thumbs up to exist, and that the states willingly entered into an agreement in the Constitution. If it weren't for the state, the sovereign states, or former colonies, then there'd be no grounds for a constitution or a nation. It's like the Constitution owes its life, like, oh, thank you very much, to the states. The states were the ones who kindly allowed the Constitution to exist and be born. And because of that, then by that understanding, then if a state is in an agreement that it doesn't like, and the agreement has its life because of the state's approval, then wouldn't you say that the moment the state goes, hey, I don't want to be in this agreement no more, I don't like it no more here, I'm getting the hell out of here, and I'm leaving, and I'm going to be my own country now, because what's happening with all y'all is not acceptable to me, so I withdraw my support of the Constitution, I'm going to be my own country. Don't you realize that's exactly what you're saying? That's exactly how this country was founded, under this concept, the stupid concept that the states were the ones who gave birth to the country, and that they never really died in the process. It's not like they kind of, yes, maybe in a sense they owe the country owes its life to them merging, and then once they merge, they dissolve and become one, et pluribus unum. But no, it was the states are still a sovereign institution that is kindly allowing the American nation to exist. Well, then when they seceded, it was their, I would say their constitutional right to do so, right? Because the Constitution was this contract, according to the conservatives' understanding. Then us fighting the South to get them back into the Union was a violation, an egregious violation of the agreement. As if to say, you're going to be in the contract whether you like it or not, and we're going to make you sign, and we're going to beat you up until you sign and come back to the agreement. That's a forcible agreement. That's kidnapping or whatever you want to call it. That's not restoring the Union. The moment they seceded, there was no union anymore. And that's how we should have seen it. There was no, the Republic in a sense died at that time. And we had to say, okay, this thing of the states being the ones who define the validity of the Constitution in our system, this concept has to die right here, right now. And now we're going to become a new republic, and we're going to go reconquer those sons of bitches, and we're going to force them back into us as a new and different republic formed in a different way, and not in a non-federalist way. But we're going to do it not because we're vindictive, but because we want to right a wrong, because we have allowed slavery to continue in North America all this time. And we're going to right that wrong. And if all we do in invading the South and beating the hell out of them is to get black people free, and the South doesn't want to join back, well, the hell with them. But at least we set black people free. And if they, put them in bondage again, we're going to go and beat the hell out of them again and again, until they stop enslaving black people. But I hope you're seeing how the Constitution just became this empty document. And that's how we are right now, again. That's why we're going through all of this. That's how we are right now in America, that we're trying to maintain, and conservatives are trying to maintain a system that just does not support life anymore, the life of the country. There's nothing in it to rescue us from the mess we're in right now. The mess we're in right now is the product of the weakness of the document, not the people who have abused it or tried to sidetrack it. They've been able to sidetrack it and abuse it because it's so weak. It's so fundamentally weak. And we're trying to stand on it to rescue us from the people who are destroying the country. And there's nothing there. It's gone. Let it go, man. Let it die. Just unplug the machine. The guy's dead. And let's start a new republic, with rewriting everything, clearing up the functionality of each branch, reshaping the legislative branch completely, the way we've described in previous audio snippets, transforming the concept of democracy, changing the voting system, from a voting system that promotes compromise and a two-party system to a system that promotes plurality and allows people of conviction to have a greater chance of election, a system where there is no party system anymore. We've talked about how the party system can be easily castrated and just rid of the power it has, a system with no lobbying, the way it's done now, and we can transform the whole system, and we can redefine the executive branch. We will someday share some audio snippets on that. We have to reshape the judicial branch. We shared a little bit of how the judicial branch needs to be transformed to become the correct agent of enforcement of legislation and the source of new legislation, but not through judge edicts coming from a judge, judicial activism, but through another mechanism that's not in the Constitution yet, where the judicial system is just a referee enforcing rules, and when the rules are not enough to rule, they can temporarily give a verdict and then notify the legislative branch, hey, you need to define the laws regarding this type of scenario. I have this case before me. I'm going to declare a verdict in this way, but you have to define the law correctly, and then based on what you decide, we either validate my decision or you're going to overturn it. But becoming the source of hole finding holes, so that the judicial branch and the legislative branch are balanced correctly. That balance of powers that the Constitution doesn't really have. We always brag about the balance of powers. There's no balance of powers. Balance of powers, my rear end. The only balance of powers, and it's a very tepid one, is between the two houses, the House of Representatives and the Senate, and with the President a little bit. But we would get rid of the two houses, so there would be no balance of power between those, because that has been a source of problems. We've described that ad nauseum. We need to redo the whole thing. And we never got to do that. And I hope we get to do that before it's too late. And speaking of too late, we'll continue on another audio snippet with Lincoln and what happened after the son of a bitch got shot to death. Thank you very much.